You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And stay tuned for another edition of The Surreal News, which is coming right up. We just finished with The Breakfast Bar and Have You Heard? Don't touch that dial. We got another great show coming up. All right, so good morning. It's Friday morning, a little chillier this morning. I'm Steve Norris, and my great co-host is Lou Larini. Good morning, great co-host.
Good morning, Steve.
Yeah.
This is a great Friday the 13th.
So we're going to talk about some sort of corruption in government today with both of our guests. So tell us about both of our guests. We're going to hit on things from a couple different angles in Florida and New Jersey. What's going on?
Well, first off, we're going to talk to Sarasota attorney Andrea Mogensen, who is leading the charge in a lawsuit filed against Governor Rick Scott and the Florida Cabinet for violating the Sunshine Laws. Go figure.
Sunshine here in Florida. And they take those laws, sunshine laws, pretty seriously here in Florida. It's interesting.
Well, I think they're good. I'm trying to remember her name. It eludes me right now. But I know it's now the Tampa Bay Times, used to be the St. Pete Times reporter, won one of their first Pulitzer Prizes for exposing violations of sunshine laws.
All right, so that's one sort of government thing. All right, that's so right. Now let's go to New Jersey. What's the other guest?
Well, the other guest is going to be, show favorite. Lou Manzo is going to be telling us about Chris Christie hijinks in New Jersey. And who knows, maybe he'll be wrapping that into some national perspective on who all is going to get the Republican nomination. As we know, Chris Christie is one of the front runners for 2016 Republican presidential candidacy.
As we promised, we have our special reporter from New Jersey, Lou Manzo, former assemblyman. He knows the inside stuff. He was he knows about the attorney general stuff, what's going on in New Jersey, and he's going to be reporting about 35 minutes past the hour. And before we get going, let's just want to remind everybody, the Homeless Marathon is February 17th. That's next Tuesday, starting 7 p.m. in the evening, going to February 18th at 9 a.m. That's the Homeless Marathon. It's going to be hosted here locally on WSLR. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later. But we do have some sort of underreported news. Do you hear about something on the radio?
Well, actually, I did.
What did you hear?
Well, I heard that, coincidentally, today is World Radio Day.
Really? How'd you hear about that?
On the radio.
Oh, okay.
You already said that.
Well, congratulations
to
us.
Yes, we did. It is, in fact, World Radio.
To radio. So everybody, well, turn on your radio.
Yeah, I mean, UNESCO. That's right.
Yeah, and if you're listening to us on the internet at WSLR.org, well, turn it off and turn on your radio.
Turn on your radio. I mean, unless you're in Bradenton, because then you won't get us.
That is true. That is true. All right, so let's do some other things. All right, something, just watch your language here, but something in Belarus having to do with mayonnaise.
Well, this is actually, it's right in line with our first guest talking about sunshine laws.
Yeah.
I just guess you can't be too careful when it comes to allowing the public to witness UN meetings. A Belarus delegate at a United Nations disarmament forum warned fellow diplomats that jars of mayonnaise could be thrown by topless women during discussions about war and peace. The delegate issued that statement of concern during the Geneva-based UN Conference on Disarmament discussion on Tuesday about improving its transparency. Belarus asked whether there was a plan to open up the meeting to members of the general public. According to the official record of the session, the delegate said such a policy could create difficulties for security and support staff. Quote, "What if there were topless ladies screaming from the public gallery, throwing bottles of mayonnaise?" asked Belarus, an official summary said. Well, apparently, the head of the disarmament conference, a diplomat from Mexico, pointed out that, members of the public were already entitled to attend plenary meetings at the conference, to sit at the public gallery, and he said it was unlikely the gallery would ever be flooded with thousands of people, noting that there were only two people in the public gallery during Tuesday's meeting. And by the way, none of them were topless or were armed with bottles of mayonnaise.
There you go. All right, so this is kind of a surreal story about a dog who escaped from his house and snuck into the hospital to visit his owner, who was in the hospital, his sick owner. And the dog was about 20 blocks away. So the dog, a miniature schnauzer named Sissy, escaped from her yard in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, walked about 20 blocks to the hospital, and snuck inside to find her human, Nancy Frank, who has been recovering from cancer surgery for weeks, and the security cameras showed the dog coming into the lobby and trying to get to the owner. Of course, their dog was not allowed, but they did let the dog in and visit briefly because the dog was there. So this is just one of those fun stories about a dog finding its owner here. The other one I'm going to talk to you about is, let me see if I can find this other one here. One second here. Is a new type of microwave. And this microwave can show you when your food is getting heated up. So if you have ever tried to heat up a burrito and you're not sure when the burrito is done or not, it's difficult to tell. So the way this works is it's a new infrared microwave, and it shows your food changing color right in the front of the microwave. So you can monitor your meal to see if it's fully cooked. So sometimes it's hard to see if the burrito is cooked, according to a NASA engineer who created this prototype microwave and patented it. And you stop the microwave and pull your food out and inspect it and try to see if it's right. So now you can see what's going on. You can see when the food is cooked. And what they do is they have infrared cameras attached to the top of the inside of the machine, and they monitor the food being cooked. In the front of the outside of the microwave is a screen displaying a heat map of what's inside the camera while it's filming. And as the food cooks, it starts out blue, which is cold, and then it works its way up to red as it heats up, and then finally it goes white hot. And that's probably a good time to take it out.
Yeah. You know, that would be actually useful, because I can't tell you how many times I put stuff in the microwave to heat up. And I usually overheat it, you know, and I take it out and I'm like real hungry, and I go and try to eat it and it burns the roof of my mouth. So now I can, like, gauge it again by color. I can say, okay.
And I think also, you know, some microwaves don't heat things fully
evenly
through,
right.
Evenly,
yeah, that's
through,
right. That's right.
And that's why I had to have the things that turn and stuff. So this would be helpful sort of to assess how well your microwave is working.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Kind of a clever idea.
Yeah, it is.
It's already patented. Too late.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's see, the Ice Age, what can you tell us? So we went from hot things, tell us about something cold now.
Well, we are learning that, you know, the ocean carbon release may have ended the last Ice Age. Apparently, carbon release from the oceans had something to do with it, and scientists have found that a release of CO2 from deep ocean helped bring an end to the last Ice Age. So obviously, that release of CO2 must have gotten captured up in the atmosphere and allowed things to get a lot warmer. Sound a little bit like climate change? Well, apparently, according to one of the scientists, Patricia Ziverin, who co-authored the new study, these results will help to better understanding the dynamics of human-induced CO2 accumulation in the atmosphere, since the ocean is an important carbon sink and the largest reservoir of carbon in our planet. So once again, Republicans in Congress, CO2 accumulation is changing climate.
Apparently so. All right, so if you want to know what the GOPs have been doing around the country since they won the past election, not hard to tell. They've been passing anti-abortion laws and restricting women's rights. That's what they're up to. So Republican legislatures across the country have made historic gains. 69 out of 99 state legislatures, 31 governorships, state lawmakers have raced to force bills, all aspects of, abortion. That's sort of what they're single-mindedly, not the jobs or the environment or the economy or other things that are important. No.
Well, they do take time out to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
That's true. All right, so here's some samples of what the Republicans have been spending most of their time doing. Not what they're saying, but what they're actually doing here. All right, outlawing most second trimester termination methods. Also requiring prior parental notification. and requiring permission of the father, and requiring patients to watch anti-choice videos. These are all separate bills before they can undergo procedures, and also requiring that the doctors have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, which, of course, we've told you is totally bogus and not required for other types of procedures, and also waiting mandates for waiting 72 hours. Another one, bills banning abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy. And also, the Republicans have also been limiting women's rights just to access of health care, just in general, for things like prevention of cancer and just routine medical care for women. So we have here groups like Americans United for Life drafting model legislation and language that's going to appear in anti-abortion bills in multiple states, kind of like what we've seen with other organizations here as well, where we have sort of Republicans behind the closed doors, sample legislation, and then we see it across the whole United States. All right, so that's what our Republicans have been busy doing ever since they swept 69 out of 99 state legislatures, not doing what they say they've been doing in terms of helping the economy. Instead, what they're doing is going after women's rights. All right, let's go to New York City. Some good news in New York City?
Well, apparently New York City set a new record. No murders for 10 days. The NYPD said the 10-day stretch breaks the 2013 record and shows that crime is falling. But criminologists urge caution and say crime swings are cyclical. The new record was set at 12:01 on Thursday, that's yesterday. No murders had been reported in the city in 10 days. The milestone broke the 9-day record set in 2013 when none were reported during the same time of year, in the chill of January. A New York Police Department spokeswoman confirmed that no murders were committed in the city Wednesday night into Thursday. But criminologists say they're reading too deeply into the statistic. They say crime, they say, swings with the seasons. Pinpointing the causes for a dip is difficult. Daniel Nagin, professor of public policy and statistics at Carnegie Mellon, said there are a lot of social forces going on. Crime rates and homicides and rates in particular have declined very substantially since the 1980s. In this one last little factoid, November 26, 2012 became famous when among New York's more than 8 million residents, no violent crimes at all were reported. How about that?
Wow.
November 26, no violent crimes at all.
Incredible.
It is incredible.
Okay. All right, so this other surreal story is the first time that a consultant had pleaded guilty to a super PAC coordinating conviction, and this has to do with a GOP consultant here. So the Republican Party political consultant pled guilty yesterday to illegally coordinating super PACs while he ran a congressional campaign in 2012. This is Tyler Haber, 34, campaign manager for Virginia Republican congressional candidate Chris Perkins. He's used his super PAC he created. He spent over $300,000 to support Perkins' campaign against the Representative Jerry Connolly, who's a Democrat, also from Virginia. And Perkins lost the race to Connolly by 25 points. Herber is the first one to be convicted of illegally coordinating between a political campaign and a super PAC. So you remember these super PACs are registered political committees that can raise unlimited sums of money from corporations, unions, or individuals, as long as they don't coordinate, with the content or conduct of their spending with political campaigns or parties they aim to support. Yeah, unless they get convicted here.
That's
so
right.
These groups were created after the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision and lower court's decisions based on the Citizens United ruling. So the comment here is that he took responsibility, Mr. Haber took responsibility for violating federal election campaign laws by illegally coordinating payments between a super PAC and a candidate's campaign committee. This is the director in charge of the FBI's Washington field office. House said in a statement. The FBI will continue to investigate allegations of campaign finance abuse, which are in place to ensure openness and fairness in elections and the people's interests are protected. Well, I think, ha-ha, but at least one case, we have at least one conviction here. Any case, he's going to be sentenced June 5th. We'll see. We'll see what's going on here. All right. I think let's do our Media Matters Minute.
I think that's right.
Okay. And then we are going to get to our first guest, who is suing our governor over some sunshine laws.
Well, her and many others.
Yes. let's see. Oh, not that one. All right. Let's get to the right one here. This is a Media Matters Minute, and then we're going to get to our first guest.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Eric Hananoki. Evangelical pastor and Fox News contributor Robert Jeffries claims that there are signs that the apocalypse is nearing. Here he is on Fox News Radio's The Alan Combs Show.
Well, there are two other things I talked about besides the rise of radical Islam, which I believe is the force. I mean, look, the Bible's very clear.
The two things Jeffries went on to list were 50 shades of gray.
The Apostle Paul said in 2 Timothy 1 that in the last days it will be terrible times. And that word terrible means lack of moral restraint. The acceptance of perversion, you know, this 50 shades of gray or 50 shades of perversion, I think that's symptomatic of what is happening.
And gay marriage.
Marriage is not a constitutional right. If it were, Alan, 15-year-olds could marry, siblings could marry.
Jeffries has a long history of incendiary remarks. He believes gays lead a, quote, miserable lifestyle and that homosexuality is linked to pedophilia. Despite his controversial history, Jeffries is a frequent guest on cable news programs. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
And I want to remind you that you're listening to WSLR FM 96.5 in Sarasota. Here's a little story while we're waiting for our first guest to get on the line. Experts are appalled by the Puerto Rican bill to fine parents of obese children. But we're going to hear more about that later, because right now, as Steve is signaling to me, Andrea Mogensen is on the phone and ready to join us. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
Yeah. Joining us today is Sarasota attorney Andrea Mogensen, who is leading a lawsuit filed by a growing number of plaintiffs against Governor Rick Scott and the Florida cabinet for violating the state's sunshine laws in the issue of the firing of Gerald Bailey, who had been the head of Florida Department of Law Enforcement, FDLE. Andrea, let's start at the center of the lawsuit. You know, why don't you tell us what happened? I know after Rick Scott was reelected, Gerald Bailey all of a sudden was no longer the head of the FDLE. Scott says he retired. Bailey says he was fired.
That's what we understand have happened. It came to light when former Commissioner Bailey indicated publicly that he did not voluntarily retire. What came out mostly in public after that was that the individual cabinet members had been told by an aide that he had retired and were asked outside of a public meeting whether or not they approved of a potential successor. And once that potential successor was approved in a public meeting, in a very short 4-minute, no discussion approval, it became obvious that there was some type of meeting of the minds outside of a public meeting. However, once former Commissioner Bailey indicated that he did not voluntarily retire, it came out further that the cabinet probably had been removed from the decision-making process with regard to the end of his tenure at FDLE.
Okay, and now to get a little legal here, what is actually the basis of the lawsuit? It has something to do with, like, violating conduits? There's some specifics about the way, you know, sunshine law must be adhered to by our public servants?
Yes, it's strictly about transparency. I know that there's obviously a lot of political overlap because it's a political decision for political reasons, but what the lawsuit concerns itself with is transparency. Both the Florida statutes and the Florida Constitution require collegial bodies, meaning decision-making bodies in the state of Florida, state, local, city, county, and other boards, subparts of those agencies, to conduct all of their decision-making process in the sunshine. And what in the sunshine means is that meetings are noticed to the public in advance. As the public, we have an opportunity to attend. minutes should be taken so that if we do not attend, minutes are required to be taken, so that if we do not attend, we can get a record of the decision-making process. None of those things were done with regard to this particular decision-making process.
You know, and just for the record, I know this seems kind of moot. You know, why are sunshine laws so important to Florida voters and any other voters for that matter?
Well, this is a good illustration of why the sunshine laws are important, because in this circumstance, had the decision regarding the apparent termination of Commissioner Bailey been made in the public, the cabinet would have known about it. Obviously, that was done without their input. But it's important because the Constitution is really the document that defines the relationship between the government and the people. And the people are really supposed to be self-governing here. And for us to be educated as voters about whether or not we want to continue with a particular incumbent, for us to be educated as voters and have input into the government decision-making process, we simply have to know what it is they're doing.
You know, that's absolutely right. I mean, I was a newspaper reporter for many years, you know, on small daily newspapers, and sat through an awful lot of selectmen meetings and wrote an awful lot of stories about the Zoning Board of Appeals, you know, and that was the whole purpose. That was what kind of drove us, is that, you know, these people can't vote or the voters can't vote reasonably unless they know what the issues are, and that was kind of what we were doing. And if government doesn't tell you, then that's a problem.
Well, and it's no coincidence that the growing list of plaintiffs are media, all the major media outlets and organizations, or most of them, in the state, because the media is the vehicle by which the people become educated. And for the media to conduct their business properly, they need access. They're the ones that are going to the meetings. They are the ones that are picking up the minutes. They're the ones that are watching, the closed circuit meetings and letting the rest of us know what happened.
Exactly. I mean, and that's why, I mean, there was a time when, daily newspapers were considered, at least by some of the owners, I know I'm from New England, you know, who may have been wealthy people, but looked at them as almost a public service. You know, they operated them at a deficit and tried to hire the best people they could to, you know, cover the news in their little community, because they did feel like it was part of, the contract, government's contract with the people to be informed. That's your, as you accurately pointed out, that's what the Constitution is about, for the people, by the people, you know.
Right.
So, but okay, you know what makes this, I guess also a little interesting, and I don't know how much you want to comment about this, is what Gerald Bailey is alleging, why he was fired's the right word, you know, asked to resign, told to resign. There's some pretty weird stuff going on that Bailey said he was asked to do and didn't do, you know, and he thinks that's behind it.
That's what I've read too. My source for that is the same as yours, public commentary by former Commissioner Bailey. The litigants that I represent are really concerned with the transparency, but, you know, I will say this, that obviously draws a lot more attention to the situation and makes people a lot more concerned, because the rationale for Florida leading really the world, because Florida really led governmental transparency laws for the United States, and the United States is leading the world. The rationale for putting this particular law into place and then further rising it to constitutional proportions by the vote of the people, I believe it was, if not the highest, one of the highest approval ratings for a constitutional amendment, is exactly the notion of backdoor dealings and sort of dirty dealings. And the way it's being alleged publicly is that's precisely what it is, that it's being alleged publicly that he was terminated in sort of retribution for not being politically beholden to the governor. Now, whether that's true or not has nothing to do with our litigation, and I can't comment on that. I don't have any peculiarly valuable information to add to that, but it again illustrates why transparency is necessary and why these laws were put into place in the first case.
You know, that's absolutely right. You know, I just have to remark that, I mean, you know, one of the articles that I read, you know, some particularly juicy allegation, I should say, you know, is that Bailey refused. Two convicts managed to get
out of jail by messing around with the paperwork, and there was a clerk of court in Orange County, you know, who was sort of the target of a criminal inquiry, and you know, the governor wanted to, you know, sort of blame her publicly, and Bailey said he wouldn't do it because there wasn't any justification, you know, and just because it embarrassed, you know, the governor's, I guess, So, you know, it just was. But anyway, though, you know, I thought that was interesting, and there was also some business about money and a businessman that you know, that the governor wanted to have appointed, who is being you know, investigated like anybody who's appointed to you know, a public office by the you know, governor, and you know, the governor had asked him to, you know, sort of, you know, lay off, have it come down for a landing, I guess, was like the phrasing, you know. This is, like you say, these are totally examples of why Sunshine is important.
Mm-hmm. And as these salacious details come out, I've heard, I should say, I haven't learned, I've heard that it was not just people being targeted for investigation, pressure to do that, but to untarget certain people that were closer to the executive office and to request what would be a misuse of FDLE vehicles for persons who were not subject to the protection of FDLE. As these salacious details come out, it just makes it more and more clear why. So it gives the impression that the law was intentionally violated for the purpose of covering up the nefarious purpose. That's why it would be beneficial to public officials to comply with the Sunshine Law, because, you know, those facts may be true or may not be true. I can't speak to that. But having chosen to operate outside the Sunshine, now as a political person, he is subject to attack, and people are more inclined to believe the nefarious purpose, because why else would you make a decision like that without the input of the cabinet outside of a public meeting?
You know, from the get-go, hasn't Rick Scott been one of our least transparent governors or least transparent political figures? I mean, I know, you know, I read the Tampa Bay Times, you know, and right from the beginning, they were talking about how it was impossible to, you know, get any comment.
And I believe that's another reason that so many media organizations are joining this litigation, is that fairly universally, I have learned outside the context of this litigation and prior to, that there was a chronic complaint with regard to access to this administration as compared to others.
You know, so I guess that's why, you know, I mean, the AP and Citizens for Sunshine and Florida Society and newspaper editors, you know, and now actually I guess the growing list includes a bunch of individual newspapers like the Palm Beach Post and I guess the Pensacola paper. And I mean, I don't know. I have the list here. I have the article that came out a couple of days ago have all joined in this suit. But, you know, here's a question I want to ask you, you know. You've been chosen to lead this lawsuit, and I assume you're the one that's going to argue this in court. Why is this a specialty of yours?
Well, I've been working in this area for some time. It actually grew out of my representation as a criminal defense attorney, trying to obtain records on behalf of my clients and being stonewalled and not being able to access what I needed. I filed one tiny piece of litigation in Sarasota County. And subsequent to that, a reporter from the Sarasota Herald Tribune had some difficulty getting answers down in the city of Venice and contacted me to assist her because I was publicly successful in a case really where access was denied. I sued to get it. They gave me the documents and that was it. And I was kind of pulled into this as an area of specialty because the media is affected so greatly. And historically, media outlets have been the plaintiffs in all the precedential cases in governmental transparency. And because I proved willing and it was published, it opened up dialogue from all sorts of media outlets and individuals because when people read, oh, you can sue to get these things, my phone started ringing. So I began to educate myself and began to work in the area. And the more work you do in it, the more work you get in it. Because when the government's involved, it usually does get coverage or often gets coverage. And it educates people that they can sue, and that when they, if they are successful in suing, that the attorney's fees are shifted to the governmental agency that denied access. And that it gives people, and there's a reason for that. It's not to make lawyers rich. It's because as an individual trying to obtain records, even if you're a wealthy newspaper, or even if you're a little old lady who just wants her records, the government's going to be able to outspend you. And so the fee shifting was put in there to put the, to correct the imbalance of power, because governmental agencies could continue to stonewall until the need for a record has passed. They could litigate with you until you, they've exhausted your resources, and that would prove to frustrate access. So the legislature shifted the fees for a successful litigant only, and that is another reason it gets so much media attention, because then the government has to pay for their denial of access.
That's great. And I just want to remind everybody that we are speaking to Andrea Mogensen, Sarasota attorney, and this is WSLR FM 96.5. That really does sound kind of Machiavellian and nefarious that the government would have done that, and it's good that those fees, I guess, have been shifted, you know, help to open things up a little bit for, you know, us regular folks. So, you know, is this sort of a major part of your practice now? I know you also have an office. You have an office here in Sarasota. Are you still a criminal lawyer?
Yes, I am. I do. It's about a third. I do about a third government transparency, a third civil rights, police misconduct and things of that nature, and a third criminal defense. Maybe criminal defense might be slightly more than that, but it's varied, but there's a lot of overlap. All of it is constitutional law in one way or another.
Well, that's terrific, you know, and I guess I personally would like to thank you for standing up for some of us, and I would like you to, you know, we're kind of running out of time here in your segment, you know, ask you if there's anything else, you know, you think you need to say that I haven't asked about.
Well, I can tell you this: I wish there were a bevy of lawyers knocking at my door for complaints to look at and bring suits, because there's a lot more difficulty. And one of the reasons this happened, and it's kind of ironic, because Governor Scott ran on a platform that he was going to run the state like a business, and this is one of the ways in which he cannot do that, because he'll run afoul of the Constitution repeatedly if he intends to run the state like a business. The state's not a business, it's a government, and the government belongs to the people. And if access is not provided, we have a constitutional right that we can bring forth in court and vindicate, and we hope to do that.
You know, I think that's a great point, and you know, just speaking to that idea of government officials saying they want to run government like a business. Well, when you run a business, you're able to pick your battles. You can decide, you know, which products are going to work in the market, which strategies are going to work, and you can abandon the rest. When you take a leadership role in government, you can't abandon, you know, the quote-unquote, you know, losers in your group because they don't make any money, or, you know, you got to deal with problems that affect everybody, you know, and, you know, so.
And frankly, running a business, you have more control.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying.
You know, as a head of a business, you can drug test your employees. As a head of a state agency, you have constitutional limitations on that.
Yeah.
You know, things of that nature. And transparency is one of them, and it's one of the most significant ones in my view.
Yeah. You know, so what's coming up next? Do we have a court date?
We do not have a court date yet. What we are doing is working on finalizing the amended complaint, because as you had mentioned earlier in the program, there's been a significant amount of interest in joining this litigation on the plaintiff side. So we're organizing all the new clients, and we're going to get an amended complaint filed probably today, if not today, Monday, and then we're going to take it from there.
Great. As this thing evolves, you know, I would like to ask if you'd like to come back on and, you know, tell us what's going on.
I'd be happy to.
Terrific. Thank you very much. We've been speaking to Andrea Mogensen, Sarasota attorney, and this is WSLR-FM. And, Andrea, you have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Right.
All right. Very good. A great guest. And this is another one of our guests who actually does the litigation. So other news reporters report on what's going on and report secondhand. We're reporting firsthand from the actual litigators who are actually litigating these suits. All right. So we have Lou Manzo from New Jersey. You're going to talk to us about Christie coming up in just a Media Matters minute.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Allie Bogan. Conservative media figures consistently misinform their audiences about contraception. Today, we give you the facts behind right-wing media's biggest myths about birth control. Conservative pundits, including radio host Rush Limbaugh, claim that birth control is inexpensive and accessible.
Birth control remains widely available. It is dirt cheap, no matter where you want to go get it.
The truth is, contraceptive access varies widely. Many low-income women don't have the same access to birth control as their higher-income peers. Right-wing pundits also falsely claim birth control is only about preventing pregnancy. Here's Fox News' Andrea Tinteros.
It's not our responsibility for the woman in the cross-stitching section to fund and subsidize her sex life.
But there are many reasons for taking contraception. In fact, about 1.5 million American women rely on the pill exclusively for non-contraceptive purposes. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
And we want to thank Media Matters. They are a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C., and they do supply us with that audio. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. News and Public Affairs. We are your true community radio station, Surreal News Show, and we are delighted to invite back to our show Lou Manzo. Good morning, Lou, is coming to us from New Jersey. How are you, Lou?
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me again.
Good, and let me just tell our listeners a little bit more about Lou, if they don't remember. Lou was a former assemblyman from New Jersey, and he was caught up in sort of the bid rig scandal under Chris Christie, when Chris Christie was rising to power. He was falsely accused of some corruption, was vindicated from that, and wrote a book, Ruthless Ambition, The Rise and Fall of Chris Christie, as well as some other things that you've done. And you've been reporting to us about Chris Christie, about his sort of ruthless past and rise to power with the attorney generals, things happening with Ashcroft, et cetera, that we've reported in the past. Did I get that right so far?
You got it right.
All right. So we have things going on fairly recently that you're going to report to us having to do with the Cowboys Jones and what's going on with Christie. So give us some background here. What do we need to know now?
Well, we're finding that his behavior and his, you know, campaign, a stealth campaign, he actually finally opened up a leadership pack to raise money without declaring, which he can do. But he's been moving around the country. He's drawing attention, and he winds up in the booth with on national TV at a Dallas Cowboys game. The Cowboys winning the game against Detroit. Camera pans up to the owner's booth, and there's Chris Christie trying to high-five Jerry Jones in the booth, and it drew questions is what is he doing there? And it turns out the answer given was that he was a friend of Jerry Jones, so he says, and Jerry Jones paid for his trip to Texas and supplied him with the gift of game tickets and entry into the stadium. The problem is that about a year prior to, or 8 months prior to that, Jerry Jones company and the Cowboys had bid, along with other major league teams, for a concession to operate One World Trade Center, the restaurant that's going to be on top of the Trade Center. And Christie and Cuomo both came out the day before the bids and endorsed. Before the board even voted on it, before the Port Authority board even voted on it, endorsed the company that Jerry Jones was involved in. It's totally against the law. It's against New Jersey ethics laws. It's against other laws. It's now under investigation, as we understand. And Christie's trying to say basically, well, yeah, since Jones is a friend of his, he's not held to that standard of the law. Well, the question is, all of a sudden this guy became his friend, and it led to another disclosure that Christie's been jaunting around the country as well as to foreign countries. He recently took a trip to Israel and to Jordan. King Abdullah of Jordan paid for that trip. That would also be a violation of laws gifting to a governor, because Christie never claimed that on any of his elects, never claimed it on his ethics forms. And as we find out, the answer to this is that he's been a longtime friend of King Abdullah of Jordan, if you would believe it. So these things are being tenuous, and the most recent thing, just the last week, was something I actually reported on in Chapter 1 of Ruthless Ambition that most of the media had scanned by when it was occurring in New Jersey. We launched on it, and now the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI are investigating Christie for apparently firing a career prosecutor in New Jersey for after he became governor. The prosecutor went after apparently supporters of him who hired illegal sheriff's agents in a sheriff's office, and the sheriff bragged, or the sheriff's offices were bragging, that Christie was going to have the case thrown out, and by golly, within weeks of that, the case was thrown out. Not only that, but the prosecutor was fired. That incident is also being investigated, and this is just, you know, typical behavior that's, you know, that I know that I've documented, that's apparent, that the public just, you know, finds out about, because now it's becoming news.
All right, so you're painting a picture here that we've talked about before of Chris Christie, who's now the governor of New Jersey, in the past using justice departments, attorneys generals, etc., for political gains, correct?
Absolutely.
All right, so give us some background here. I know we've discussed this in the past, but Chris Christie himself was an attorney general at one point.
He was the U.S. attorney for the District of New Jersey, and he literally used the office, as is documented in Ruthless Ambition, he used the office to prosecute companies and individuals to raise money for his goal of running for governor, and to get the political opposition out of the way. He targeted his prosecution so that there wouldn't be anybody standing in his way when he ran for governor. And, you know, we use documents and whatever to prove that. The other thing he did was he let a few of the people who were close to him off the hook, as we find out, who were incriminated on FBI tapes and were apparently awaiting, you know, potential criminal probes. He loosened the strings up as a U.S. attorney, and he let those guys off the hook.
And this was part, one of the things you reported, there was a bigger picture going on where Ashcroft was using state attorneys generals to promote political gains for Republicans throughout the country, correct?
That's right. What he was doing basically was he actually almost invented what they call the deferred prosecution agreement, where he would go after a lot of industries. We have a lot of pharmaceutical industries and health health device industries up here in New Jersey. He would go after them, potentially prosecute them, because they used to advance doctors, you know, free samples in exchange for the endorsements for their products. He was calling it bribery, Christie, and he threatened to prosecute the CEOs of those companies unless they agreed to what he called a deferred prosecution agreement, whereby he wouldn't arrest anybody, wouldn't prosecute anybody. What they had to do was pay a fine instead, and then have set aside money for Christie to hire a lawyer for them to monitor them. And the lawyers Christie was hiring, by and large, were the people like Ashcroft, $50 million. Others in the state of New Jersey who were the significant contributors to his campaign war chest when he ran for governor. So he was hauled before Congress on this, chastised on it, and actually wound up that they had to pass laws to prevent this from reoccurring, incidents like this from reoccurring, so other U.S. attorneys wouldn't follow his path.
And you mentioned these law companies being sort of hired and getting sort of easy money here.
Yeah, well, Christie got to pick them. I mean, it wasn't like gone through a bidding process or anything. You know, the person being prosecuted just signed a waiver, said, you know, the U.S. Attorney of New Jersey picks whatever monitoring firm he wants to monitor me, and I got to pay them.
All right, so linked together, Samson, and you also mentioned Port Authority sort of being caught up in this thing. So link these things together now.
Well, Samson was also one of the he was a former New Jersey State Attorney General. He was they used to call him General Samson, one of the key architects of Christie's campaign for governor, and he also benefited from a lot of these deferred prosecution. Corrupt scandals. When Christie became governor, he appointed him as the executive chairman of the Port Authority to New York and New Jersey. And this guy is going to be at the hub when this whole investigation opens up on the George Washington Bridge scandal. You're going to find this guy Samson's fingerprints all over it. He is also the guy who was accused of shaking down the mayor of Hoboken at the time. You know, he's executive chairman of the Port Authority, and he's withholding Port Authority funding and Sandy money funding that the city needs. He's using his clout at the Port Authority to withhold it unless the mayor, and this is the words of the mayor of Hoboken, by the way, unless the mayor of Hoboken agrees to give his law firm a contract or a person who his law firm is representing a contract to do Port Authority work in Hoboken. It's incredible. He has since resigned. He's under federal investigation right now for those and other allegations. And these are the things that are on the surface that are boiling over, which is literally going to blow up in Christie's face, should he continue on with his quest in trying to become the nominee of the party.
All right, well, you mentioned a little bit about Bridgegate, and the last time we had spoken to you, Christie had just had his own investigation, which had exonerated himself from Bridgegate, and we had sort of left it there. So bring us up to date as to the months that had passed with Bridgegate, which we haven't really heard very much since then.
Well, we haven't heard much because, like I've always said, I don't see the U.S. attorney in New Jersey really going after or pinning it on Christie. I see him hanging this around the neck of underlings, and pretty much this investigation has now gone on longer than the Warren Commission, if you will. It basically could have been over had the U.S. Attorney's Office simply given two or three individuals that nobody cares about a waiver to testify in lieu of being prosecuted as to what everybody wants to know: was Christie involved? Instead, they've drawn this out, and even though they've drawn it out and they're going to go after people, the more people that get hit with this, they're still going to be on Christie's payroll. There's still going to be people who are involved in his campaign. It's going to be a mess for him, even though it doesn't touch him directly. The indirect assault, especially the one with Samson, is going to be enough to damage him on the national stage, as well as these other picadillos that are coming out, like the prosecutor, the instance of the prosecutor in Hunterdon County that I spoke about, which I think is much more serious than this, because there's evidence of him having done this, and we present it in the book in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And by the way, the book, it seems, is becoming a gingerbread trail, if you will, that's leading to a lot more of these investigations that are opening up on Christie as he goes forward. So he's really taking on a lot of water now, but he's still a significant person in the GOP primary wave, because he still holds the ability to raise the most money, and he still holds the most IOUs and chits out there, aside from his, collapse at the polling lately.
Yes, and I was going to talk to you about that, about sort of how Chris Christie fits in with the pre-primary. So we have sort of an early primary where the Republicans are just trying to get as much money as they can, and that's sort of, whoever raises the most money. And let me just remind listeners again, Lou Manzo, former assemblyman from New Jersey, we're talking to him from New Jersey. He was caught up in the bid rig scandal and accused incorrectly of corruption. He was completely exonerated and wrote a book, Ruthless Ambition, The Rise and Fall of Chris Christie. And now he's telling us a little bit more about that.
Well, no one in that whole RGA field can match Christie for Machiavellian tactics. And him ascending and him wanting to take the chairmanship of the RGA was, you know, what that wasn't by, you know, coincidence. He wanted that. That was going to be his way to winning the nomination for the presidency. And what he's basically done is he's really taken out Romney. And the reason I say that, and he's probably going to take out Bush, Jeb Bush's candidacy next. And how he's done that basically is as the leader of the RGA, he's raised astronomical amounts of money for Republican governors throughout the country. There's now 30 Republican governors in this country, more than 30, okay? As chairman of the RGA, he put all those guys together when he was stepping out after he had helped to reelect them and elect new ones. At that meeting in Florida at the end of November of last year, when they emerged from those meetings, there was a pattern forming of comments from the governors. And basically, there was an agreement made amongst them that the next president is going to come from amongst the governors. Even though that some of them are going to run against each other, they agreed that when the dust cleared, it was going to be one of the sitting governors that are memberships in this RGA that's going to be the nominee of the party. And guess what? Even though Mitt Romney had was leading in the polls, if you will, the people wanted him to run, he couldn't get one governor to stand with him. And then when he went to fundraisers out there who he had previously had, they were locked up by these other governors. Many of them have contracts in these states, so none of them are going to stick their head out there to help anybody. They're basically keeping the money close at home, and it's frozen out Mitt Romney. I'm going to predict that it's going to freeze out Jeb Bush. But Christie can't get himself, you know, off the ground because of all this bad publicity lately. And the guy that's really benefiting right now and who I see as the potential dark horse winner here is going to be the governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker. I see him as being able to pick up all the markers here because he hasn't alienated many people. Christie's taken all the heat. The only question is can Walker compete with Christie without the money, and can Walker loosen up some of the IOUs that are still in Christie's camp?
Very interesting. Let me just mention here, the RGA is the Republican Governors Association, and Chris Christie is the head of that.
He was the chairman, right, the last chairman.
Correct. All right, so let's talk a little bit about money, and we've been reporting about the Koch brothers. So tell us a little bit about some of the relationship, if you're aware, between the Koch brothers and Christie and the governors.
Well, the Koch brothers are in with, you know, they sprinkle their money around until they, you know, they can smell, you know, they'll come in heavy at the, once the nominee is chosen. But the guy who's really the kingpin right now for Christie, as far as the biggest fundraiser he has, is the Home Depot co-owner, Ken Langone. And it's all these minions of fundraisers through the RGA that Christie's put in place. And as a matter of fact, there's been another of these ongoing investigations by the newspapers in New Jersey that are pointing out all these people who contributed to the RGA, a lot of them that are contractors, that are sending money into other states for other governors where Christie helped elect them. They're all winding up with contracts, it seems, in New Jersey, including some who invested money for the pension fund up here, lost the pensioners tons of money. It was reported in a lot of national news updates relative to businesses. The bond rating of the state has collapsed under Christie as a result of some of that. But again, the key thing into winning a nomination, not necessarily is popularity at this point. It's going to be troops on the ground and money. And Christie, remember, is going to lead these states in going into that because, again, he has most of the IOUs from the people he just helped elect, and he has the money right now to do it. He doesn't have the popularity. That's what's holding him out. And the other thing he's banking on, Steve, is that the last two nominees from the GOP didn't win in Iowa and had a little bit of trouble in New Hampshire. So, you know, he's hoping he can get by there. If Walker wins Iowa, which he's on track to do, and New Hampshire, and can do something in Carolina, then it's a runaway train. So right now, Christie's ambition, I believe, is to concentrate, you know, on just playing the field a little bit there and blowing Walker away with the IOUs he has and the money as the primary and as the caucus gets closer.
And if you recall going back for the Koch brothers and Walker, when Walker was breaking the unions and doing his things, the Koch brothers were heavily behind that. So Walker has
that's correct.
His heavy
I would say
there.
Walker would have the edge in getting money there because, you know, they're no fools, the Koch brothers. And Christie, you know, once you get to know him, you know, I'm only saying this because I know all the scandals that he's involved in and all the things that can blow up on him. But there are other people out there who don't pay attention to this stuff and are unaware, and they might be tempted to throw a little bit of money at Christie right now, throw him, you know, side in with him, support. But as soon as they, you know, start seeing these scandals, you know, and get a wind of them, they're going to fly off of him rather quickly.
All right, so we have a couple minutes left. Lou Manzo, he's a former assemblyman from New Jersey, is reporting to us about Chris Christie and his book, Ruthless Ambition, The Rise and Fall of Chris Christie. Take a step back and just tell us, big picture stuff, is Christie going to make it? Is he going to survive? And what's his role going to be in the presidential campaign for the next
I don't think
years?
He'll survive as a candidate. I believe he'll become a kingmaker. And all these guys would die to have him. Like him or not, he did an outstanding job in helping to elect more than 30, elect and reelect more than 30 Republican governors in the last election. The thing that everybody should be concerned about, does he try to get a quid pro quo for his help to become our country's next attorney general should the person he supports for president win? That would be more frightening than him as president, actually, based upon his actions as a U.S. attorney. And that's what concerns me.
How about VP?
I don't think so. I think damaged goods for president, damaged goods for VP, and, you know, it's one of the reasons why, as I point out in the book, Romney dropped him from consideration. There's too much out there that the public doesn't know yet. It's all in the book, Ruthless Ambition, if the public does want to know what's about there. But this will all come out if he, you know, once his name is on a ballot.
Fabulous. All right, so we're done. Thank you. Lou Manzo, reporting to us about Chris Christie from New Jersey. Lou, thank you, and we really looking forward to having you back as this tremendous story unfolds.
Great, Steve. Good talking to you again. Thank you very
good
much.
Good luck with your blog, and tell everybody if they want to follow your blog.
Oh yes,
how do they do?
We have a website, ruthlessambitionthebook.com. Go to that website. There's a blog listing there, and I update it, you know, at least twice a month.
Yeah, so what you've got is quotes from the book, and then updates about what's going on. It's absolutely wonderful.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, again, I want to thank Lou Manzo from New Jersey, our remote reporter, about Chris Christie. And we're just about coming to the end of a show. And, yes, we're going to thank you. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to remind everybody to come to Fogartyville tonight and see Roy Bookbinder.
Oh, he's great.
The good book. Oh, yeah, Roy Bookbinder. I'm a big Roy Bookbinder guy.
Big friend of the station.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. He's fabulous. And also, too, what else is coming up next week?
All right, again, a homeless marathon from February 17th to February 18th, and WSLR is hosting it this year. If you're concerned about the homeless, please come. And there are toll-free numbers to call the marathon. During that, we're going to be giving those out during the marathon here. And we care about homeless people here in Florida.
And there are tons of good stuff going on here at WSLR, and I would have to say I happened to be at the Blair Crimmins and the Hookers concert last Wednesday, and those guys were amazing. They blew the roof off of Fogartyville.
I was just about at the end of a show, and I just want to remind people the news and views you heard here are not those of the employees or its board members. It's hosts or co-hosts just to the people that gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. We've certainly had some controversial guests on in general and certainly today as well. After this show, I just want to remind people we have Complex Waveforms, which is coming up in a minute. And we've got, well, one of my favorite songs coming up. We have John Coltrane with My Favorite Things coming up, oh, in just about a minute. So don't touch that dial. Also, I want to just remind people Stratosphere Sarasota, which I co-host with Nancy Norris, which is on every alternate Wednesdays from 9 to 9:30, a science and social science show with great guests as well.
Aren't you going to have an extra special guest next week? Or is that this week?
That we already had. We had Arlene on Wednesday talking to us about campaign nonviolence, which is going on, which is very, Arlene was our guest on Wednesday. Also, just want to remind people that we do podcasts, and it's thesurrealnews.com. If you want to hear of any of our previous shows, it's available. We're also streaming at WSLR.org. And of course, we're also on the radio at WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. We are your true community radio station. Well, it's going to be a little cooler today. Otherwise, a nice and bright sunny day.
Blue skies.
Blue skies, yes. All right, so we have Complex Waveforms with the very talented Mark Zampella. We've got My Favorite Things with John Coltrane coming up. This is one of my favorite songs, so I want to thank Mark Zampella for playing this. All right, stay tuned for My Favorite Things with John Coltrane and Complex Waveforms. Here you go.